Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to protecting, educating, and promoting Florida's hospitality industry. Over 10,000 members providing over 1 million jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at frla.org. And from the Florida Wildlife Federation, supporting acquisition and stewardship of Florida public conservation lands, including programs like Florida Forever, Everglades Restoration, and more. The Florida Wildlife Federation. More information online at fwfonline.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Unusually early in the session, Florida lawmakers are inching their way towards a final budget both House and Senate can call their own.
Let me just say that if we've got $1 billion or $2 billion that we can return to the taxpayers, I completely agree that they can spend it better than I can. But we simply aren't there.
Also tonight, a pilot program for contraceptives is moving forward in the Senate, and it's gaining support among some Republicans.
If we don't pay for it on the front end, we're going to be paying for it on the back end.
We'll also get the latest on possible changes to how the cost of juvenile detention is split between state and local government, and new assurances that every ballot cast in a Florida election will actually count. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's day four in this fifth week of the Florida legislative session, and this is Capitol Report. The Florida House and Senate gave tentative approval today to competing spending plans that hover around the $80 billion mark. Republicans touted tax cuts, while Democrats railed against budget cuts. Jim Ash has the story.
The Senate wants to give Governor Rick Scott's recruiters $250 million to attract businesses. The House does not. The House wants $1 billion in tax cuts. The Senate says no way. Haggling over the differences will color everything that happens for the final half of session. On the House floor, Republicans patted themselves on the back for finding a way to cut another $1 billion in taxes, tuck away $2 billion for a rainy day, and still increase education spending. Here's how Republican Danny Burgess of Zephyr Hills describes it.
Florida policies have helped foster over the last year 233,100 jobs, and our job growth rate is higher than other fiscally responsible irresponsible states within the nation. And that proves that our policies are working, members.
And here's how Republican Manny Diaz of Hialeah Gardens describes it.
This is a historic level of funding, which is $105 higher per student than the 2007-2008 levels, which everyone always speaks of.
One of the biggest ignition points was abortion. The House bans any spending on Planned Parenthood. Republican Representative Larry Ahern referred to controversial videos taken in a Texas clinic that purported to show staff members negotiating the sale of fetal tissue.
We've all seen the videos. We know what's going on. The dirty little secret is out. So we have another way.
But Democrats were quick to correct the record. They pointed out that a Texas grand jury cleared the Houston clinic and indicted the filmmakers instead. Representative Kevin Rader of Boca Raton pointed out that investigations ordered by Governor Rick Scott also came up empty-handed.
I'm curious how much evidence of mishandling of fetal remains existed at any of the 16 clinics investigated across the state. I'm curious. I haven't heard anything.
Democrats also pointed out that tax cuts aren't free. Representative Cynthia Stafford of Opa-locka said the plan rewards businesses and corporations at the cost of public health.
The budget cuts over 700 positions in the Department of Health. It cuts those positions at a time when Florida is seeing the highest number of new HIV/AIDS cases in the nation.
That's not to say there weren't bright spots. Representative Gail Harrell of Stewart reminded critics that there's money in the budget set aside for the environment.
Legacy Florida is going to be a dedicated funding source for Everglades restoration. We're putting $198 million into this national treasure.
But if anyone thinks the negotiations will be sunshine and roses, Senate Appropriations Chairman Tom Lee of Brandon says think again. Here's what he told his colleagues on the floor before the conferences began.
Let me just say that if we've got $1 billion or $2 billion that we can return to the taxpayers, I completely agree that they can spend it better than I can. But we simply aren't there.
Meanwhile, the governor has some ideas of his own. He's proposing a $79.3 billion budget that cuts taxes far differently than the House. And Scott has the line item veto. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Some lawmakers are pushing for a pilot program to increase access to long-acting contraceptives. Nick Evans has more.
The Florida legislature's Republican majority passed an abortion waiting period last year, and it's working on a handful of new restrictions this year as well. But a handful of Democrats, like Minority Leader Arthenia Joyner, are trying out a different answer for unwanted pregnancies.
The goal of the pilot program is to offer birth control to women with the intent of lowering the number of unintended pregnancies and abortions. It creates a pilot program, Hillsborough, Palm Beach, and Pinellas, to offer intrauterine devices and implants to participants.
The pilot focuses on long-acting removable contraceptives, or LARCs. These come in different forms, small T-shaped or matchstick-sized implants that reliably prevent pregnancies for 2 to 10 years. On the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, House sponsor Lori Berman of Boynton Beach contrasted the approach she and Joyner are following with that of the GOP.
SB 1116 and HB 947 safeguard a woman's right to choice and to control her reproductive rights. This is the kind of legislation Florida should be adopting instead of the draconian measures proposed and adopted here in the Florida legislature.
So far, Berman's side of the effort hasn't gone anywhere, and it's not going to.
This will be the last meeting of our committee.
That's Kerry Pigman, a Republican from Sebring. He's a physician, and he chairs the Health Quality Subcommittee. That would have been the first stop for Berman's measure. Part of the reason the proposal isn't gaining traction in the House is how it provides LARCs. Family planning services are already available through county health departments, but the contraceptive pilot directs the Department of Health to contract with outside organizations to expand access. Berman's measure falling on deaf ears is perhaps less surprising in light of the House taking steps to block funding from heading Planned Parenthood's way. It's certainly not the only family planning agency in the state, but it has been lobbying in support of the plan. In the Senate, though, Republicans have been more receptive. Registered nurse and Sebring Republican Denise Grimsley is co-sponsoring the bill.
Regardless of what causes the unintentional pregnancies, we've seen a considerable rise in the last few years. And if we don't pay for it on the front end, we're going to be paying for it on the back end. And I just want to thank you. I hope that I'm around long enough that I see this as a statewide program and not just a pilot.
The Senate bill has one last stop before the floor, but it's a committee controlled by Miami Republican Anna Terry Flores, one of two lawmakers to vote against the measure at its first stop. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a long-running dispute over whether counties or the state pay for incarcerated kids could be near a close, with the state owing most counties money.
And by and large, the estimate is that the state is the one that owes the preponderance.
A bill still moving through the process aimed at helping those families who want to rebury their loved ones' remains associated with the troubled Dozier School.
That's probably the thing that most disgusts me about the whole situation of the Florida Industrial School or the Dozier School. It's not taking care of those children after they died.
And hundreds of Muslims gather at the Florida Capitol to share the message that they are a peaceful, productive part of the community who pose no threat to non-Muslims.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
This might be the year the Florida legislature finally settles a long-running dispute with counties over the incarceration of juvenile offenders. Lynn Hatter reports a bill by Clearwater Senator Jack Latvala does what the counties have sought, a 50-50 split on detention costs.
In 2004, the Florida legislature made a rule requiring counties to pick up 74% of the cost to incarcerate juveniles. The state paid the rest. Counties sued, upset about the uneven split, and the issue has been in the courts ever since, with most decisions in the favor of counties. Now Senator Jack Latvala is proposing a solution.
The states and counties will pay the same rate for a day of detention care and an equal 50-50 share for detention costs, with counties paying its proportional share of actual costs on a monthly basis. It is estimated that this legislation will provide counties almost $12 million a year in savings in the first fiscal year.
Latvala's bill seeks to put an end to the back and forth. A measure last year would have split costs 60-40, with counties paying the majority, but that failed. Under the previous court rulings, the state owes most counties money. Republican Senator Travis Hudson wants to know if the bill would apply to counties that owe the state.
But there are some counties that owe us money right now. They have not paid, and I know one of specifically. Does this address any issues that's outstanding owed to the state where they're not reimbursing their bill?
The Florida Association of Counties, Lisa Hurley, says the bill would settle all claims, including the few counties that owe the state money and those the state owes.
It is the intention of the legislation that there are, from both sides, money, credits and debits owed on both sides. Mm-hmm. And so with the passage of this legislation, that it would resolve all of those outstanding differences between the counties and the department.
Perfect. Thank you.
And by and large, the estimate is that the state is the one that owes the preponderance.
That was Latvala. Committee Chairman Joe Negron says he wants guarantees from the counties that they will drop their lawsuits against the state in exchange for the new policy.
I personally want to see contingent upon the bill passing and becoming law, of course, but releases and dismissals with prejudice of litigation once this, if it passes and if it's signed into law by the governor.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Hurley says out of the 23 counties that have sued, only two, Collier and Bay, have agreed to drop their suits, and she expects those two counties to sign off on the deal soon. The juvenile detention cost fight has been going on for more than a decade. Supporters say the passage of the bill will give both the Department of Juvenile Justice and local counties predictability in their budgets. The House version of the bill by Representative Chris Latvala, the senator's son, has not had a committee hearing yet. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A bill seeking to help the families impacted by the now-closed Dozier School for Boys is still gaining traction in the Senate. And as Sasha Cordner reports, the measure now includes some new changes.
Senate Democratic Leader Athenia Joyner is sponsoring the measure related to the Dozier School for Boys in Marianna, a former North Florida reform school with a troubled past.
It has come to light that the reform school era was rife with reports of physical and psychological abuse of children by staff at those facilities. There was a small white building on the grounds where alleged atrocities occurred, including severe beatings, which allegedly resulted in deaths. That building was dubbed the White House. While there's documentation of problems in the operation of the school and treatment of its residents, former residents have also alleged that sexual abuse occurred.
Alleged abuse survivors have come forward calling themselves the White House Boys. Among them is Jerry Cooper, who says as a teenager he passed out after he was beaten more than 130 times in one night.
Such a basically ugly situation for the state of Florida.
Cooper recently spoke before the Florida cabinet after they heard a final report about the property. Over the past few years, University of South Florida researchers excavated 55 unmarked graves and found the remains of 51 people. And through DNA matches, they've identified 7 boys. But a majority of the remains have still not been identified, and Cooper says he knows there's more unidentified remains buried on the property that will probably never be found. And he says that's tragic.
I don't know what happened at Marianna. We don't even know who these children are, except through scientific and DNA analysis. And Being a soul that stayed there back in the 60s, that's probably the thing that most disgusts me about the whole situation of the Florida Industrial School or the Dozier School is not taking those children, taking care of those children after they died.
The researchers' goal is for families to be able to rebury their loved ones, and that's expected to cost up to $7,500 each. And Joyner's bill aims to compensate or reimburse those families.
With this bill, we are providing certainty to the families that they can bury their children with the dignity any of us would want for our own, without having to worry about not having the funds to do so or having to depend on the whims of charity. This was a tragic and unfortunate situation in Florida's history, and this is a small step toward rectifying that.
Her bill also sets up the Dozier Task Force to come up with a memorial for the unclaimed remains, as well as figuring out the memorial's location.
The task force will recommend an appropriate memorial and come back to you next year for funding for that memorial.
Joyner changed her measure Thursday to outline the makeup of the 8-member task force, which will include former wards of the Dozier School for Boys, Jackson County commissioners, and a family member of one of the boys who died identified through DNA. They'll also include an NAACP member, as well as someone from the Florida Department of State who will serve as the chair. Originally, the bill also required the preservation of historical resources and artifacts recovered from Dozier to be transferred to the Florida Department of State, but Joyner changed that at the Secretary of State's request.
The amendment clarifies that the historical resources and records will continue to be properly archived, preserved, and maintained where they are now at the University of South Florida until such time as the department requests custody, and so this will relieve the department from having to find space and appropriate accommodations for the materials until such time as they are ready for it.
One last change allows for the University of South Florida researchers to continue their work in identifying the exhumed remains and matching them with next of kin using DNA. And the measure passed unanimously Thursday in the Senate budget panel that looks into transportation, tourism, and economic development issues. It now has one more stop before heading to the floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Lawmakers are moving forward with a measure aimed at helping ensure more people's votes are counted, and we get that story from Regan McCarthy.
During a presidential election in Florida, thousands of provisional ballots are left uncounted. In some cases, that's because voters forgot to sign them. And Jacksonville Democratic Senator Audrey Gibson has a bill to do something about that.
It's a very simple bill, just allows a voter who casts a ballot but fails to sign his or her name to be able to cure that deficiency, just like a voter can cure that deficiency on a vote-by-mail ballot.
A vote-by-mail ballot or absentee ballot allows someone to request that a ballot be mailed to their home. Then they mail it back or drop it off at the supervisor of elections office. And sometimes voters make mistakes when filling those ballots out, like forgetting to sign them. But Gibson says there's a plan in place to address that, and she wants that same plan to apply to provisional ballots, or a ballot that's voted in person at a polling location, often when there are questions about a voter's eligibility.
The process for the provisional, curing the provisional ballot already exists. There's nothing new that has to be created. It's parallel to the absentee ballot curing process, so there's nothing extra that has to be done.
But Ron Lebowski, who represents the Florida State Association of Supervisors of Elections, says the change isn't needed. He says mistakes on provisional ballots are rare.
I reviewed the 2014 Federal Election Administration report that's filed by the Department of State with the federal government that follows every election that we have. And in 2014, we had 5,392 provisional ballots that were appear to be rejected based upon that report. 31 were rejected based upon the failure to have no signature.
And Lebowski says unlike mail-in ballots, provisional ballots are filled out in person and under a poll worker's supervision.
So based upon the personal involvement of those individuals, I'd have to suggest to you that the reason that those 31 ballots were not counted was because the individual who had started and initiated the affidavit with the chief deputy at the polling place assisting them chose not to execute the affidavit, and thus it was not signed.
Lebowski says the affidavit requires a person to affirm they are a registered qualified voter, and filling it out fraudulently is a felony. So he says it makes sense that a person who is not legally registered to vote wouldn't finish the affidavit. But Gibson says that's an unfair characterization and says it makes sense that legitimate ballots could be missing signatures and could slip through the cracks. And she says in some cases, just one or two ballots can make a difference. She gives the example of a special election in Duval County.
There was a two-vote decision that decided that race. And so any one missing ballot could change the outcome of an issue or who's elected to office.
The measure has passed its first two committees in the Senate. It's awaiting its first hearing in the House. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Governor Rick Scott wants the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to send more water south from Lake Okeechobee to reduce the impacts of ongoing releases from the lake into the Caloosahatchee and St. Lucie estuaries. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers increased flows from Lake Okeechobee last week in an effort to stem the rise in water level brought about by recent heavy rains. In a letter today to the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Civil Works, Scott wrote that the releases are impacting wildlife and the economy of communities that rely on the estuaries. State lawmakers have complained that such releases have negatively impacted property values of the communities around the estuaries. Scott added in the letter that he's directed the Department of Environmental Protection and the South Florida Water Management District to help areas impacted by the releases. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Well, Friday or no, a few things will be happening at the Florida Capitol tomorrow, and Ronald J. Eben brings us the highlights.
As usual, Friday will be an abbreviated session with lawmakers heading home for the weekend early. At 8:30, the Education Estimating Conference will analyze enrollment in pre-K through 12th grade, a meeting at the Knott Building. At 10 o'clock, the Senate Transportation, Tourism, and Economic Development Appropriations Subcommittee will meet. The Florida Supreme Court is expected to release its weekly opinions at 11. At 12:45, the Florida Commission on Access to Civil Justice, created by Supreme Court Chief Justice George LaVarga, will meet. The commission is looking for ways to increase access to the court system for low-income Floridians. The quarterly Missing Endangered Persons Information Clearinghouse Advisory Board will meet at the Florida Department of Law Enforcement Headquarters. That meeting set for 2 p.m. And those are some of the legislative highlights for Friday, February 12th. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
Finally tonight, hundreds of Muslims gathered in the Florida Capitol today to lobby and engage in the political process. The event is part of an annual Muslim Day of Advocacy. But as we hear from Kate Payne, this year is different. For one thing, anti-Muslim sentiment seems rampant, and it's an election year.
During the legislative session, citizens and groups from across the state come to the Florida Capitol to lobby their lawmakers and make their voices heard. Usually, those groups don't have to hire a cop to protect them as they walk the halls. Thursday was Florida Muslim Capital Day, an annual day of advocacy for Muslims from across the state. Here's Ghazala Salam giving the group the safety spiel.
So what are we going to say if somebody's following you or you feel that you're not in a safe space? Good. You have to say it loud. Can you say it louder again?
All right, great.
According to the Pew Research Group, most Americans know little or nothing about Islam. Tamim Chowdhury is with the advocacy group Emerge Florida. He says this is an opportunity to put a face to the word Muslim.
You may be the only Muslim that they actually meet all year, or you might be the first Muslim that they've actually really communicated with or had a conversation with this year, or ever, to be quite honest. So you are ultimately serving as a representative for not just yourself. You're representing as a member of the entire Ummah.
Organizers say every legislative session is another opportunity for Muslims to get engaged in the political process. But Wilfredo Ruiz, with the Council on American-Islamic Relations, says this year is different. It's an election year and a year when xenophobic rhetoric is taking center stage.
It's like a zombie, a dead man walking, this xenophobia. It appears to be there for some time, and then, especially during electoral years, it kind of resurrects, and there it goes, a xenophobic discourse and Islamophobia that unfortunately appeals to a small sector, very, very voiced sector of our society.
But Ruiz says the rhetoric of politicians like Republican frontrunner Donald Trump is motivating.
The negative rhetoric we're listening to against immigrants, against women, against Muslims, that really have been a motivator for our community to go come out of their houses and precisely participate in these kind of events.
After breakfast, the group walked through a brief training session, a sort of how to speak with your lawmaker 101, and then they split into small groups and took to the halls. But Angeliz Ruiz is worried that lawmakers won't care and won't listen.
We must do stuff that they've already heard. Like, it's obvious okay. that it's persecuting people, it's obvious that it's discriminative, like, they already know that.
Yeah. At least one lawmaker was listening, Senator Dwight Bullard of Miami. Bullard met with the group Thursday and was quick to call out Donald Trump.
If he checks his history books like I check my history books, he'd know that when Thomas Jefferson was Secretary of State is when he received his first copy of the Quran on his travels abroad. So we've had a presence of Muslims in America, an interwoven part of the American tapestry, since the 1700s.
Wilfredo Ruiz says xenophobia is just a part of the Muslim experience in America, but he hopes his community remains engaged, whatever happens this election season. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FBRCapReport and join us again each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to protecting, educating, and promoting Florida's hospitality industry. Over 10,000 members providing over 1 million jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at frla.org. And from the Florida Wildlife Federation, supporting acquisition and stewardship of Florida public conservation lands, including watershed and springs protection, gulf restoration, wildlife and fisheries conservation, and more. The Florida Wildlife Federation, fwfonline.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.